When someone you love is facing cancer, you want to do more than send a card or flowers that will wilt in a week. You want to actually help. That's where the Balm Box comes in. Our care packages are built from research with over 500 cancer patients and caregivers, packed with items people actually use during treatment. Think soothing, practical, thank goodness I have this kind of relief. For you, it's not just a gift. It's a way to show up in a moment where words fall short. For them, it's comfort, calm, and a reminder they're not alone. From chemo-friendly boxes to mastectomy recovery kits, even options for men, we've made it simple to give something that's elegant, premium, and genuinely useful. And yes, domestic shipping's always free on orders over $50, because making someone feel cared for shouldn't be complicated. So skip the empty get well soon. Send real help, real comfort, and maybe even a laugh. Visit thebalmbox.com. That's thebalmbox.com. Balm, like healing and care. The Balm Box. Because cancer patients don't need bouquets and brownies. They need Balm.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. I never miss a chance at self-indulgence when the opportunity arises to mention that I was, in my past life, a social worker with the elderly and disabled from the age of 15 until my early 30s. I bring it up a lot because it's an important part of how I developed into what I am: weird, darkly humored, highly questionable, which is how Dark Topic has been described by critics. I started in nursing homes with the dying, lending an ear and a hand to the mouth, wanting a drag of my cigarette. You could smoke in private nursing homes back then. At least we did. I graduated to the streets with the homeless, but dropped out after a couple of years of that. I had a father from whom I'd already learned much of in the field, or should I say the ditch, who was difficult to manage, and those unhoused gentlemen I'd helped process at the shelter were worse than even him. I had, until that point, romanticized the hobo through literary works like William Kennedy's Ironweed and Jack Kerouac's Dharma Bums, but these were not hobos I was dealing with. I was out there trying to shine up street trash and getting spit on for my efforts. So I shifted focus from shelters to societies like that of the John Howard, eventually becoming a child and youth counselor in a variety of group home settings. These group homes that became like a home to me were the type of places not many go into. They were secret places, meant to keep a low profile, as some of the residents were under protection after having been mistreated by a family member or guardian, and now they were what's called a crown ward of the CAS, the Children's Aid Society. They had been removed from their home due to abuse and placed in the care of homes like the ones I supervised as a frontline staff. And I know you've heard this in some way or another from me in the past, but I'm going to lay it all out right here because this story forthcoming sparked it in me to tell it. I was made for social work, from my nature to my nurture. I wanted to make things better. I wanted to be a good person. In practice, I wanted to be a good person. I wanted to soak up the worst of what the world had so that one day maybe I could wring myself out through writing like Bukowski or like a Hunter S. Thompson type. And I will, though those two authors aren't who I model myself after any longer. I'm trying to find my own way, and I will write, I hope. It's just that I'm not full of enough shit yet, though some might disagree. From the start, my awakening was a rude one. The nursing home clientele wasn't old men sitting around talking about the weather. It wasn't old women sitting talking about old men. Most of them were insufferable, bitching assholes, and who could blame them? After a long life, they'd ended up there, filed away for safekeeping, shitting their pants, losing their minds, looking at the window to a view of a parking lot. These old folks weren't in the mood for a kid like me. They were jealous. I was a reminder of their lost vitality and youth. In some cases, I was a reminder of their children and grandchildren, whom rarely visited them. So, like I said, my awakening as a young teenager into the world of social work was a rude one. But again, I was made for that. I can take a lot of abuse, and I know how to calm seemingly uncontrollable patients down. You just hear them out. You don't feed it. You bleed it. The old folks were easy, for the most part. I learned there to listen. But in the group homes I graduate to with the Crown Wards of CAS, with those kids and young adults, it was different. I'd be physically attacked in there. I'd have my patients worn thin by the shouts, screams, and violent actions of that group in those group homes. There is no listening with the nonverbal. Most people couldn't handle half a shift in these places. In fact, most of the staff I'd attempt to train for the job would go up in a puff of smoke on their first smoke break. It's a madhouse in these places. And I'll give you a typical shift. 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. was mine, Monday through Friday. Then every other week, I got a Monday-Friday off, but worked Saturday, Sunday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. I'd be on call for a week of every month and would end up doing an overnight shift, sometimes after my 3 to 11, which isn't legal. But when it comes to kids in need and there's nobody there, they overlook these things. I distributed medication, so much of my shift would be collecting a resident to administer the medication by mouth, syringe, anally. This was a home with 8 residents and sometimes only 2 staff. We'd get them off the bus, many by wheelchair, change their diapers, then start doing the medication. 8 kids with severe mental and physical disabilities, not to mention the behavioral issues that come with that. And for the most part, your job is to keep them safe, to keep them contained, really, or occupied. And there's all these wish list side quests that the Children's Aid wants you to complete, working on life skills, while you as a staff are fighting for your own life just to get 8 kids medicated, fed, clean, and eventually into bed without anyone escaping at a door to go flailing into the street, or a resident eating all the cotton out of a cushion, or one of them using their teeth for ripping a chunk of flesh from a sedated kid in a wheelchair, being fed from a bag into a feeding tube. It was chaos. And I did it all day, all night, for years, making $15 an hour, barely able to breathe between shifts where I'd take an hour-long bus ride with a bunch of able assholes on a crowded bus. But I'm not complaining. I'm just trying to express that when I hear of abuse occurring within institutions, perpetrated by the staff, I'm not aghast. I don't condone it, obviously. But I'm simply not surprised. Underpaid, overworked, and hidden away in the halls of hospitals or homes with the hideous. That's the world I knew. We worked with those that most don't even know are in existence. And it takes a special person. Sure, here's another one. Somebody's got to do it. I used to take frequent walks with a resident of the home I worked at, using a leash connected to them with a harness, through a local park, and they were not well behaved. I spent a lot of time picking them up, pulling them away from people, like, who's walking who, am I right? And I'm like, holy fuck, what is that? It was really fucked up. And I was required to do this with a harness as they were a danger to run into the street, the creek, or even a ride-on lawnmower if it passed us. They wore a helmet with a plexiglass face shield to prevent them from pulling their own eyes out to eat. One was already missing. They would self-induce vomit frequently because the life they'd lived previously had been one without adequate food. I'd have to lift the helmet from the face to let the vomit stream out on those walks. I didn't want them to choke. I'd clean them up when we got home to a place where 7 other residents had their own issues that I had to attend to, that included things beyond what I just shared, things most people have never imagined, let alone seen. And when they do get a glimpse, without fail, it's the same 4 words. I couldn't do it. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The homeschooler. Okay, there's a point to that whole intro. It did get away from me a bit. I'm going to pull back, you know, reel it in, get this thing under control, limit any mess I might need to clean up later. All I'm trying to say is that I know how this work can be wearing. The institutions, the infirmaries, they are far from safe havens for their employees, let alone their clients. And I hate to admit that I understand why. Staff are dealing with patients, inmates, clients who are a threat to themselves and others. And the patients, inmates, clients are dealing with overworked, underpaid, unhappy hires for the most part. A lot of the time, they aren't the best for the job either. Because of the underpayment of these employees, you don't get the best attracted to these jobs. They are not easy places to be for anyone. And like I bravely already said, I don't condone it. The abuse of the mentally disturbed, the disabled, the elderly, it shouldn't happen. It's a bad thing. And that being said, I totally get it. Strong arm tactics are great for blowing off steam and getting some respect in order. And I'm kidding. Do I need to say I'm kidding? I probably do. But in this case, in our case, for Dark Topic here, in a foster home, where conditions should be manageable, chaos and overcrowding not as prevalent, you'd think, hearts and minds meeting in a place of pursued peace and prosperity, I don't get it. Especially to the extent that the guardians here became ghouls. This shit, I don't get it at all. Except for maybe the idea that some of those who are willing to take in foster children aren't in it for the right reasons. Perhaps. You know, I'm just guessing here, spitballing. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. I'm not qualified to judge. Because in this case, I couldn't do it. Bring a potentially disturbed child into my home to coexist with my children. And I guess with my experience, technically I could do it. I wouldn't do it. How about that? Shamefully, I wouldn't. As bad as I feel for kids in tough situations, as much as I always told myself that one day I would adopt, foster, I never did. At this point, I struggle with the idea of taking in a dog from the shelter. And I guess my charity burned out somewhere along the way. I tell myself that I already did my part. Sure, I'll speak up if I see something shit going on. I give money to beggars. I'm appropriate with women, kind to the elderly, good with kids. I tip well, always a firm handshake and a solid look in the eye when meeting men. In the park washroom after dark, I'm generous. And here we go again, up to my old tricks with that last one. Always screwing around. The gallows humor, you know, they always talk about that, the gallows humor. You gotta laugh to keep from crying, eh? I'll wrap it up. Put a bow on this drawn-out intro, one that was meant to put you in the holiday spirit, believe it or not. We can't save the world, but we should, at the very least, take care of our own families, our own issues. Around the holidays, many of us are moved to extend our concerns to our community. We might put a jar of peanut butter, a few bags of chips, a couple cans of corn into the food collection box at the local church. It makes us feel good, to do good, to be good. Today's story is about a family that went much further than good, all the way around to bad. They were of the ilk that distributes your canned goods to the needy, sings carols on your doorstep on Christmas Eve, wild-eyed with stretched smiles, dressed like scarecrows with bonnets on their heads. The Williams family were heavily involved in the church, ultra-religious, and therefore thought it necessary to be ultra-charitable. What they overlooked in their pursuit of doing well, which led them to adoption, was how difficult it might be to transition traumatized adolescents straight from the scorching heat of Ethiopia to the relatively cold Pacific Northwest, just 40 miles south of Canada is where they lived, freezing there when you're forced to eat your frozen vegetables outside in your school clothes, specifically your homeschool clothes. The Williams family lean on this. Like many in the field of charity, of helping others out, of being a good person, they say this that many of us say, and that is that we meant well. The Williams family meant well on their path to hell. Evangelical Christians Carrie and Larry Williams of Skagit County in Cedro Woolley, Washington, population 10,000, wanted more than just their seven children accrued by 2008. But Carrie, a housewife, had run out of blessings from the big guy above, and Larry, a millwright for Boeing, was A-OK with that. Nine mouths to feed is probably good enough, Carrie. What do you say we just focus on what we got here? Be thankful for the seven, raise them up right, and maybe we can go on a date or something soon? Wait, are we allowed to make love still if the babies aren't coming after? I better check my Bible. The Williams, whom wed when Carrie was 19, looked both to be in their mid to late 30s by 2008, but Larry was apparently much older than Carrie, and hard as I tried, I couldn't get a clear gauge of age on the stern-looking couple. Something about practicing hardcore Christian values that seems to suck the life out of a body. Speaking of life from body, Carrie decided that even though Jesus had turned off her tap, they weren't done raising way too many kids at once yet. Carrie had been trained as a sign language interpreter and felt that this skill could be put to good use in adopting a deaf child. Carrie had become quite adamant that they should adopt. Her boys, all with first names beginning with J, five of them, were growing up and soon would leave the house. Her two girls, with names that rhyme with Carrie, were going the same way. And all seven were so well trained and behaved that adding more kids seemed like it would be more a blessing than a burden. Larry worked long shifts at Boeing, making good money. He was gone from noon to midnight each day. Carrie wanted a challenge. And after attending a woman's retreat with the church, she came home with the answer. Many women and her church had started to become involved in the trend of the 2000s. That is, within these heavily religious circles, the trend of adopting kids from Ethiopia or Liberia, Africa. Adoption could be damn competitive, a form of flexing on your fellowship even. Look at me, I've got 8 kids, and 5 of them are black. You know what that means. Did you know that Meredith has 5 African children, all from different fathers and mothers? What a saint. Carrie badly wanted that distinction to be seen as a stern, saintly servant of the latter days. She already had the aura of a movie monster witch. Carrie was anti-feminist, believing a woman's place was at home, making dinner, babies, and clean bathrooms. She didn't believe women should be allowed to vote, wear swimsuits, and the rules of their rural farmhouse-style abode were quite strict, as I'm sure you can imagine from learning that. Carrie's hope, as mentioned, was to get a deaf child. She wanted to teach her own kids sign language, and this addition would give them reason to practice. The Williams family ended up applying to become adoptees through AA1. They were required to take a home study course and test. Larry and Carrie avoided filling out the section on their beliefs in disciplining children, which should have raised a red flag, but didn't. Soon, by mid-2008, they were in the adoption office, watching heart-wrenching video of African children, malnourished and clearly in need. One boy, 7-year-old Emmanuel, caught their eyes as he had limited use of his own. That one. That's the one for us.
And holy shit, I'm mixing up Emmanuel being deaf with being blind because I want to make shitty jokes throughout my episode.
Then they saw Hannah. Hannah Alimu, 11 years old, a beautiful little girl, though only weighing 77 pounds, had been abandoned by her family, just like Emmanuel. After learning that she and Emmanuel were like siblings, Carrie and Larry couldn't pass on the chance to make that reality for them. We'll take them both. Back in 2008, the process went like this for adoption.
At least with AA1, that's Adoption Associates 1.
Once a family was deemed appropriate, and they'd chosen a child or children, the kids were put on a plane and sent over. The first time Emmanuel and Hannah would meet their new family would be when they were dropped off at their rural countryside home. Hannah had read Little House on the Prairie to her new little brother on the trip from Ethiopia to Sedro Woolley, Washington. They were taken in with open arms to a spotless home and seemingly perfect parents, sisters, and brothers. The adoption agency was so impressed with the setting that this would be their only visit. Updates would, for the following year, be done through mail. The agency learning that Hannah had gained 50 pounds and that Emmanuel was grasping American Sign Language well. By June of 2009, all communication had stopped between the agency and the family of 11. The kids were homeschooled and lived in the middle of nowhere. The only time they were seen was at a single doctor's appointment in late 2008, where progress seemed great on the kids' health, considering. And other than that, the family was observed rarely on walks together and in church. Well, they weren't completely together on those walks or in church. People would later comment on the oddity of Hannah seeming to always trail behind. Uncommon goods, everybody. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. I got something here for the Secret Santa I have to attend, and some of those people there are drinkers, so I thought, hey, these Himalayan salt tequila glasses, a set of 4, these are going to be a hit. They naturally salt the tequila or the mezcal for you. And they got a little tray for your limes
in a board that it comes on. I'm going to get invited to every single Secret Santa available in coming years in my community. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. From moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers and sports fans to foodies, mixologists, and gardeners, you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. Support artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase at Uncommon Goods is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So, don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/darktopic. That's uncommongoods.com/darktopic for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. Carrie would share with her church friends that Hannah was quite rebellious, but that with the help of a popular book in ultra-religious circles to train up a child by the incredibly creepy and rich Michael Pearl, they were figuring it out. Pearl and his controversial book had come under much scrutiny around this time for the disciplinary teachings in his book To Train Up a Child. Millions of copies sold, 700,000 in its first publication. Overzealous parents had been killing their children using his methods. Misusing, he would tell you. Though it does say in the book to use a switch made of tubing so that the parent could curl it up and be armed with it at all times, he recommended using it on the feet so as not to leave obvious marks that may alarm heathens to intervene in your practices. Michael Pearl, he's big on withholding food or making food less appealing as punishment. Lock them in closets, make them sleep on the floor, force your kids to do jumping jacks in the cold when they misbehave. Beat the devil out of them, basically. Here's a quote from Michael Pearl, a man who looks like he follows the Old Testament, and though he resembles a lumberjack version of Santa, I doubt he dresses as such. More fear than sheer with these assholes. Quote from Michael Pearl. I laugh at my caustic critics, for our properly spanked and trained children grow to maturity in great peace and love. Carrie Williams clearly missed the properly part, and the whole lot of these folks missed the signs of the devil, a false prophet. Incredible that evil seems to live so close to those dedicated to repenting it. Personally, I think that the constant talk of evil draws it nearer to one, speaks it into existence. And if I'm right, you might want to turn this next piece of the episode down. We're going to hear the 911 call that ends this episode here. This occurred May 12th, 2011, just past midnight. On this call, you will hear the voice of Carrie Williams.
What's your emergency?
Yes, I think my daughter just killed herself.
Why do you say that?
She's really rebellious, and she's been outside refusing to come in, and she's been throwing herself all around, and then she collapsed.
In the months leading to this call from Carrie Williams about her adopted daughter Hannah being really rebellious, throwing herself to the ground and trying to kill herself, a lot had been going on. From the start, Hannah had been caught trying to steal food, probably because she came from a place with only flies and puddle water on the menu. She had started her period, which freaked out Carrie. Hannah was positive for hepatitis B, something they found out at the doctor's. Carrie complained to her church friends that they really got screwed by the adoption agency by being pushed to take the little girl in a package deal with Emmanuel. Carrie was remembered as stating in a knitting circle that, quote, I wanted to adopt a little girl, not a half-grown woman. Blood from Hannah's menses, was allegedly found by Carrie on the walls and door of the bathroom. Carrie took this as a behavioral issue. She told her husband and children to stay away from Hannah. Carrie became convinced that the little girl was trying to infect them all with her blood-borne illness. Carrie had quickly found the presence of her newly adopted children to be a nuisance, as Emmanuel and Hannah were having great difficulty living up to the impossible standards of the Williams household. There are many stories of families adopting from foreign countries, children who have been traumatized in unthinkable ways, and sent the kids back, so to speak, as they weren't the malleable, humble, appreciative little things they'd expected to adopt and, have hanging around their necks
like possessions, like showpieces. Carrie was having a really bad experience here, or so she claimed. And when asked by her fellow parishioners why she didn't return the children if they were too much to handle, Carrie responded with, quote, "Oh no, I couldn't do that. I wouldn't wish these kids on anyone. I'll handle it." Well, I couldn't do it. That's the sentiment from the church gals. And Carrie no doubt felt special, holier than thou, for seeming to be able to handle it. Here is how, in fact, Carrie handled it, and how we came to hear that 911 call. Carrie Williams followed the rules from her parenting guide on corporal punishment of children. Hannah, from the start, was disobedient, which in a strict Christian household is probably pretty easy to be. She was 11 when she arrived, 13 when she died. Emmanuel was 7 on arrival and was easier to control. Emmanuel would suffer some of the forthcoming descriptions of abuse, but not all. He would later communicate through sign language in court proceedings that he didn't understand what was going on, that he was scared, and that he was beaten, and that Hannah had probably gone to hell, but he wasn't sure where she was. They both were starved, but being from Ethiopia, that maybe didn't register with them. What did was the way they were fed, as punishment for not meeting the family standards. Most of Hannah's meals were served outside on the porch. She never really gained favor with Carrie, whereas Emmanuel made it to a proper bed most nights and to the dinner table, the result of finishing chores and doing schoolwork to Carrie's standards. Hannah just never complied once the behavior modifications began. She would be beaten, starved, and humiliated for 2-3 years here. Most of the time, Hannah was kept in a 4x2 closet in the dark. On many occasions, this was her punishment, with Christian music playing from a ghetto blaster pushed to the door, Carrie and Larry turning down the music and messaging to read scripture to the girl on occasion, crammed in there, defiant, refusing to be good for them. She hated it here. Hannah wouldn't give them the satisfaction of yielding to their demands. But they were satisfied, I believe, in their sadistic treatment of Hannah. The kids got in on it too, watching and finding amusement in the girl's insolence, helping to hold her down for whippings. After a while, Hannah didn't even cry. She just quietly took her punishments, then was sent to sit in the closet or the property outhouse. When she did eat, it was as prescribed by the book to train up a child. She would get leftovers, and even those were made to be less appetizing by being wrapped in bread and dipped in water first. Hannah eventually got back down to her Ethiopia weight, even though she was forced to eat her vegetables, frozen vegetables. And let me be clear, they would give her frozen vegetables straight from the bag, pour a handful of frostbitten carrots, broccoli, and corn on top of her soggy leftover sandwich, then slam the screen door and head back to the warmth of the family dinner table. Hannah had food, you see, but she just refused to eat it, and I don't blame her. Punishments included walking the line. That would be laps of the pickleball court and the desolate property that was nothing like the girl had imagined from her Little House on the Prairie readings. Hannah would be showered outside with the garden hose, no matter the weather. Hannah was quite proud of her hair when she arrived. This she lost after having cut the grass too short. Her head was bald when she died. Emmanuel had bedwetting issues and was forced to sleep in the dark shower room if he had an accident, this after being hosed down with cold water. Larry would get particularly frustrated with the deaf child's inability to react to Larry's demands, once hammer-fisting the boy to the top of the head, causing a gash and blood to run down the 10-year-old's face. Carrie would take her plastic tubing switch from where she kept it handy, her bra, and run the switch across Emmanuel's face as warning to pay attention. The deaf boy had his head in a swivel as he desperately tried to avoid missing anyone's attempt to grab his attention. Hannah, as I mentioned, most often slept in the closet, but was kept in the outhouse while menstruating. The other kids got punished as well, but not as severely as Emmanuel, and not as horribly as Hannah, who was slowly dehumanized until she was so withered and withdrawn that her routines eventually involved pure punishment. Hannah was helpless to improve, you see, and meet Carrie and Larry's standards, as she never had time to recover from the start. Her legs and feet would have indents in them from the whippings by her end. Also, Hannah had a painful stomach infection that never saw treatment,
And I could wallow here for a while, but I think I've painted you the picture. So now let's put it all into motion. It was a cold, drizzly afternoon, Wednesday, May 11th, 2011, where Hannah finally broke. 13 years old, 5 feet tall, 77 pounds soaking wet. Literally, she had been sent out into the rain this day as punishment for being unable to do her schoolwork or her chores. Hannah was wearing only a t-shirt and shorts. The temperature was just below 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 5 degrees Celsius. The little girl, after an hour or so, begins complaining that she's cold. Carrie, annoyed, takes a page from To Train Up a Child and demands the girl do jumping jacks to stay warm. Another hour passes, and the kids are giggling at the window from inside. Carrie looks out to see what the source of amusement is. Hannah is flailing around and falling to the ground out there. Mother Carrie tells her kids to get back to their schoolwork, then exits the home and grabs Hannah, who's dripping wet, by the arm and starts dragging her to the shelter of the outhouse. Hannah continues to act strangely and falls over, so eventually Carrie drops her to the ground and tells the girl to have it her way. She leaves Hannah lying in a puddle of the lawn. Lying, after all, is what Carrie believes Hannah is doing. Another hour passes, and Carrie puts some dry clothes on the back porch, then yells out for Hannah to come get them. When she doesn't appear, Carrie sends her eldest boys to beat her with plastic tubing switches on her bottom until she gets up. They do as asked, but Hannah doesn't respond. She eventually begins to mewl and sputter before stripping her clothes off and screaming at the young men. They run away with hands over their eyes. One of mother's highest sins would be the revealing of a female body. When they tell their mother of the behavior, she runs out to cover Hannah with a sheet, not for the girl's comfort, but to protect the eyes of her children staring from the window. After dinner, the children are at the window giggling again. This is a great source of amusement. Hannah is now naked and roaming around the yard. She begins throwing herself to the ground, and the kids are told not to look, as it will only egg her on. Carrie doesn't bother to check outside until closer to midnight. When she does, she turns on the light from the porch and she sees the ultimate horror of this all. Hannah is out there slamming herself into the grass and then into the driveway. She's then smashing her face into muddy, gravel-filled puddles. The girl is covered in wounds and blood. She is destroying herself. And Carrie shouts out that the devil is inside that one. Come look. The whole family watches, fascinated, from the window as Hannah tries to dig herself into the muck out there, her bloody face looking up at them hideously from time to time in the light off the porch, as if to say, farewell, I'm going to hell, where you say I'm from. I'm going home. Nobody thinks to stop her. Hannah is scaring them. This, of course, is not a demon child attempting to find her master of the underground. This is a tortured little girl who's been out in the cold all day, soaking wet and naked, too thin to trap any heat, and now is suffering from hypothermia with paradoxical undressing. Hannah has the sense she's burning up and is attempting to burrow as a way to escape her misery. The Williams family are waiting for Dad to come home and handle this. Hannah has never gone this far with her poor behavior, and they're at a loss as to what they should do. Carrie actually calls Larry to get his advice, and he suggests they wait for him. But then Hannah stops moving. What should I do now, husband? Maybe you should go check if she's all right. When the boys get to Hannah, she is nearly dead. Her mouth is full of gravel and mud, and her eyes are black from pupil dilation. Carrie orders them to wrap the girl in a sheet and bring her inside. This is when Larry suggests on the phone that his wife call 911, which is a big annoyance for Carrie. She refuses to perform CPR, as Hannah has hepatitis, which to her is gross. Also gross, Hannah has mud in her mouth, so no way, I'm not guessing that. Besides, the girl is clearly on her way to death. Hannah, as Carrie put it to the 911 call operator, she had a look about her as if she was in a dark room. On the 911 call, as we heard some of, Carrie tries her best to pin this all on Hannah. She has a tone of the girl being a nuisance and claims Hannah was just being really rebellious, throwing herself around until she's near killed herself. Needless to say, the authorities didn't buy it. How could they? Look at what was being sold. Hannah at the hospital by 1:30 a.m. is pronounced dead. Carrie and Larry claim their daughter was possessed by the devil. What else could explain the way she'd torn herself to shreds until death released her? Well, Mr. and Mrs. Williams, it's called paradoxical undressing. It's also called first-degree assault of a child and homicide by abuse. That charge, homicide by abuse, can only stick if the child is younger than 16. In court, Carrie and Larry swore that Hannah was at least 16. They believed they'd been lied to about the girl's age. This led to Hannah's body having to be exhumed. It was eventually determined that the girl had, in fact, been 13 years old at the time of her grisly death. One more act of disrespect to be checked for something that was already known. Carrie Williams, whose age at the time of sentencing I finally pinned down as 42 years old. Carrie, she received a sentence of 36 years. Larry, in his 50s, was handed 27 years for his part. He'd been at work that fateful day, but for his abuse of poor Emmanuel and support of Carrie's homeschool teachings, he got the book thrown at him as well. Speaking of books, it was found that Larry Williams, who along with his wife was forbidden to speak of the trial to their kids, was sending the kids cryptic messages through the Bible, highlighted sections about being delivered from the mouth of the lion, basically telling the kids that they needed to back up their parents' lies to help them get out of this mess. The two parents, who seemed so defiant and united in the beginnings of trial, begged for leniency in the end, turning on one another, pinning blame, showing their true colors, a cold grayness, like scum. Their children were handed to family, while Emmanuel found a nice home with a hearing-impaired woman with African roots, I read, just like the boy. I read that Emmanuel suffered from nightmares and some survivor's guilt, but he ended up safe. He was overzealous with cleaning. He was wondering why he wasn't beaten when he first got there. And it was quite sad, the story surrounding Emmanuel. Hopefully he's okay today. The Williams home did a real number on him. And that's saying a lot for a deaf kid from Ethiopia who had been abandoned by his parents, that he could be so traumatized over here in the States in a home like that of the Williams. Speaking of that home, when investigators first began looking into Hannah's strange and awful demise, they were struck by how clean that home was. Not impressed, but rather disturbed they were by it. The home, after all, was cleaned constantly by 9 motivated kids and young adults. Well, 8. Carrie would tell you 8, because Hannah doesn't count. Hannah Alimu was remembered with a headstone and an obituary. Both were handled by the Williams extended family. The obituary spoke of how Hannah loved to knit and read and write, and especially do crafts. The headstone is even more infuriating. The family lists Hannah as Hannah Grace Rose Williams, born 1995, which would have made her 16 years old at death. They perpetuated the lie told by Larry and Carrie. But should we be surprised? Extreme beliefs make for strange groupings that put ideology above all else. And in times like these, those in those strange groupings will take care of their own, whom in this case were known as the homeschoolers. You have been listening to Dark Topic Plus, an exclusive piece of content. Icecock Doors Lock, stay paranoid. Talk at you soon.